And I'm delighted to say that right now we are joined by Ian Dale on Fresh Air Radio, broadcaster and writer. Ian, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It's very kind of you.
Not at all. Looking forward to it.
Wonderful. So I'd like to start, if I may, about talking about news coverage right now at the moment. And by that, of course, I mean coverage of Ukraine. There are some stories in news media that just require blanket coverage, aren't they?
Yep.
Just by dint of their scale and significance. And Ukraine is obviously one of them. And I'm interested, because you're now dedicating virtually the whole of every programme on LBC to Ukraine. Do you struggle to find, you know, new, unique, creative ways of covering the same story from different angles every single night? Or do you think because the scale of the story, there's just so much to talk about?
I think more the latter at the moment. Yeah. The invasion happened, nearly 2 weeks ago now. You're right, every single program since then. And I've done some weekend shows, so that's probably about 11 programs, 3 hours, yeah, mainly devoted to Ukraine. Cross Question, which comes in the middle of my program. Virtually all the questions have been on Ukraine for that. Not all, but virtually all. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you have to respond to the public. We are, as broadcasters, led by what the public want. And we know that if the public are getting tired of it because the phone calls dry up, yeah, they really haven't dried up on this. And there are lots and lots of different new angles. And I can't say so far that I've ever gone into the newsroom and thought, oh God, which bit of it should we do today? It's relatively obvious what we should do. And we do try and create new angles. For example, last Thursday, I did an hour on what I've called war anxiety, the, yes, mental health consequences of this, because a lot of people are feeling really anxious in this country I'm talking about, not necessarily in Ukraine. And when you hear talk of nuclear war, people do get very frightened. So we did an hour on that, which is actually bizarrely quite uplifting in a way. I remember three, yeah, of the female callers that we had. I ended up having a real laugh with them at the end of the calls, which you don't normally do on a mental health phone-in. So that was something different. We've also done one or two Q&As with experts, which I think people, I mean, look, I don't know if you knew much about Ukraine before this, but I certainly didn't.
No, I didn't.
A lot of people have, sorry, it's my dog. A lot of people have lots of questions, which maybe, yeah, they are afraid to ask because they might think they might look stupid. Mm. So last Thursday, we got Michael Clark, former Director General of the Royal United Services Institute, Ben Judah, who's written a book on Putin. He was live from New York. And we spent an hour taking questions. And I had an email from somebody who said, In my 71 years on this earth, that is the best hour of radio I've ever heard, which I thought was quite a nice compliment. And then on Saturday, I was doing the Saturday morning show because Matt Fry, who normally does that, he's in Ukraine.
Yeah,
and we did an hour with Bill Browder, the anti-corruption activist. And again, it was just amazing. The questions that came in, all super intelligent questions. It was just a real pleasure to host. So, I mean, you can always do, should we be taking more refugees? Should we be imposing a no-fly zone? Those have been obviously two of the main subjects, but you are always looking to do something a little bit different.
Yeah, and would you agree that I think phone-in radio is sometimes looked at from quite a snobby point of view in this, yeah, country? You know, I wouldn't want to attribute that to a particular, you know, another station, people from another station saying that. But, you know, there is a view sometimes that phone-in radio is, you know, slightly easier, slightly less serious.
You mean people who listen to Radio 4 say,
well,
that.
I that's didn't say it. You said
no,
it.
No, I know you didn't, but that's what you meant.
some people think that phone-in radio is slightly more, you know, less serious, let's say. Mm. But actually, I've found in the last few weeks listening to LBC that it is at times like this where it really comes into its own, because you don't hear... Yeah. The views of, you know, fascinating people who have sometimes hugely unique perspectives on some of the events.
Well, let me give you an example, yeah, on that. When this all really started boiling up about 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago, I think it was the first phone-in I did on Ukraine, and a guy called Tom in Brighton phoned in, and he just started... I thought he was going to be... not a very good caller when he started, because he seemed to be quite nervous. Mm-hmm. But once he got into his stride, he gave us a sort of, I don't know, 8-minute potted history of Ukraine, because he'd worked in Moscow, his wife was Ukrainian, his ex-wife was Ukrainian. And I basically didn't say anything for 8 minutes, which if you've listened to my program, is not the norm.
Yeah.
And And I had so many texts and emails and tweets afterwards saying, oh my God, that was fascinating. We want to hear more. So I rang him up after the program and I said, would you like to do a podcast on the history of Ukraine? So we did that, did about 40 minutes, put it up, and it got thousands of downloads. And you just never know what the next call is going to be. And yes, look, you get idiots phoning in. I mean, I won't deny that. But generally, if the host of the show sets the parameters properly, you can get some cracking calls and calls that actually tell you more than if you had a reporter on the scene. I know that sounds weird, but sometimes ordinary callers who've got a unique perspective on a particular story, they can give you something that a reporter never can. And particularly when you're talking about emotional subjects like depression, grief, things like that, people have got their own stories, and you don't need to have sort of dozens of people phoning in. You need four or five people with good stories. You let them tell their story. So it's not a sort of 90-second phone call. It can be 4, 5, 6 minutes, even longer. I mean, I have done half an hour once before when they've been absolutely superb. Because in a way, as my boss or my ex-boss used to always say, we're not a music station, but our callers are our hit records. And he was, I mean, it sounds a sort of David Brent thing to say in some ways, but it's absolutely bang on.
Yeah, it is. I remember in, must have been during the pandemic, I think you did an hour-long phone-in on victims of male rape or something, which is something I just have never heard covered on commercial or national radio, and it was a fantastic hour. As you say, you're not talking about hundreds of callers, you're talking about a few incredible.
Well, it's funny because we did get hundreds of callers on that. Oh, really? And I remember when I first suggested to my producers that we do this, they looked at me as if I was mad, because, and I knew what they were thinking. They're thinking, who is going to phone in to talk about being raped, particularly if you're a bloke? And I said, just trust me. And within 5 minutes, full switchboard. I mean, we literally had hundreds of calls that hour. And it was the sort of thing where I wish we had another hour and we could have carried it on. Because often on phone-ins like that, and particularly on mental health, people often think that they're the only ones that are experiencing what they're experiencing. And of course, what those kind of phone-ins, they tell people that they're not the only one. And it's an enormous relief in a way, I think. And I think it encourages people to maybe get some help if they need it. I mean, not everyone does. And also if you've got yourself as a presenter an angle to this where you've experienced something, you should bring that in. There are some presenters who just view themselves as the sort of conduit. Whereas I think, look, I mean, I always remember one of the first things I was told when I started at LBC was give of yourself. But I mean, I had an experience once where that nearly happened to me. And so I related that on the radio as a way of encouraging people to phone in and tell their stories. And believe me, it worked.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk about, setting the parameters of the program. And this is a question more for me as well as my audience, but I'm aware that a lot of the producers that you work with are considerably younger than you. And so what is that relationship like? Who controls the direction of the program? You come into the office and you say, right, these are the stories in the news. Obviously the producers have, the remit of their remit partially is the direction and the content of the program. But obviously you're also a presenter who's been in this business for a very long time. How does that relationship work and that conversation go on a daily basis?
Well, you're right. I'm very old, so inevitably the producers are a lot
younger.
You're
going to say something like that.
I think, the oldest producer I've had, I think, has probably been about 34. My two producers at the moment, one is 29 and one is 23. And in a way, there has to be this relationship of mutual trust.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some subjects or some, I mean, for example, if a comedian dies who was really famous in the 1970s, they will have never heard of him or her, generally him. And I just have to say, trust me on this one. Our audience will know who this is. We need to do a sort of little obit thing. So there is a sort of, it's sort of, they live by different cultural memories than I do. So there's that. I mean, in the end, I'm the editor of the program. It's my decision ultimately as to what goes out and what we do. But I can't really ever remember having to sort of say, I don't care what you think, we're doing it my way. The relationship, if you have to do that, it would generally mean that the relationship doesn't work very well. It's always, and sometimes when we've got four or five different subjects we could do for a phone, and sometimes I'll just say, oh, you decide. Mm-hmm. But it's generally a decision that we make. And because I broadcast my program from a different studio now at 4 Millbank, which is opposite the House of Commons, on Thursdays I'm in Leicester Square, but Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm not actually in the newsroom. So it's all done by telephone. And they normally come up with some suggestions. We then have a chat at about, I don't know, 3 o'clock maybe, make the decisions, and then I basically leave them to it. If I've got suggestions for guests, or if I've got a contact for a guest, I will ring them up to us to come on the program. But generally, they do that, all the legwork. And because I completely trust them, I don't really interfere. And so when I get into the Millbank up to now it's been at 6, but of course Andrew Marr's starting today. Yeah. So he's got the studio, so God knows how I'm going to work. But yeah. I get in there, I write my 6:59 talk up, we pre-record that. I might do a pre-recorded because we do cross question Monday to Wednesday. The 7:45 to 8:00 section of the program is always pre-recorded, so we have time to get the guests into the studio. So I might do a pre-record for that. So it's all quite smooth, but then of course you can be thrown completely off course when at 5 to 7 there's a breaking news story, and you think, okay, let's scrap everything. And I love that. I mean, breaking news is kind of what I live for, because the adrenaline flows. It's just great.
Are there any particular memories of covering breaking news on LBC that just stand out as, you know, phenomenally exciting?
I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but I love covering terror attacks. I mean, I would never want there to be one, just course. So I can cover
from
it.
From a journalistic point of view.
From a journalistic point of view, you want to be on air when something big is happening.
Because people are coming to you for that.
Yeah, and they do come to us because they know what we will be doing.
Yeah.
If they go to 5 Live, they might be covering Wimbledon or some sporting event.
Yeah.
Radio 4 very rarely break into their schedules for a news story. So we are the one place that people know that we'll be on it for however long it takes. And I mean, the one that I suppose sticks most in my mind was nearly 9 years ago now. I just started doing the Drive Time program. Mm-hmm. And just before we came on air, we heard reports of some sort of vicious attack in Woolwich. And it turned out to be the terrorist murder of Lee Rigby.
Yeah.
Now, that was at about 3:30, I think I first heard of that. So I was going on there at 5 to 4. And we knew by this stage that someone had been killed. We didn't know the horrific circumstances. And I saw my producer, Matt, who was on the phone. I was thinking, why is he on the phone? Why isn't he telling me what I ought to be doing? Because I had no clue what I was supposed to say when I went on air at 4:05. And he just sort of motioned to me, it's going to be okay. So I worked out he was speaking to somebody. And I had tweeted about 3:30, if anybody saw anything, get in touch.
Yeah.
Well, he was talking to a guy called James, who had been standing 3 yards away when it happened. Wow. And he happened to follow me on Twitter. And so he then came on the program at 4:05. He told me all that happened. And it was quite horrific detail, which you have to remember, at 4:05, mothers are still picking their kids up from school. They've got kids in the car, listening to the radio. And then they hear this guy saying, and then he chopped his head off.
Yeah.
Now, there are Ofcom regulations about that sort of thing. So I had to sort of quickly think, should we be doing this? And then I thought, you know what? Sod it. People need to know the horrific nature of this. So just carried on. Anyway, talked to him for about 10 minutes. And that was it. That set the whole program up, really. Mm-hmm. And I was on air for 4 hours that night, just doing this, nothing else at all. And it was, I think that was the moment when at the end of the program, I thought, you know what, I can do this.
Right.
Because I'd had no journalistic or broadcasting training. Mm. I was flying by the seat of my pants for the first 2 or 3 years. And I mean, I quite enjoy that sensation in many ways. But there is a potential for doing, for saying something that really will come back to haunt your whole career. Yeah. But that evening, I did think to myself afterwards, we did a bloody good job there. And we did, which was acknowledged by the BBC when they held an inquiry as to why their coverage was so awful.
Oh, really?
And they kept playing bits from our coverage to teach their people on what they ought to have been doing.
Wow.
So
that is a compliment, yeah.
It really was. And that's where we're so nimble, in that we only have... If I want to do something, I mean, whether it's on a breaking news story or whether it's just a normal program, if it's something that's remotely controversial, I only have one person I need to go to say, yeah, this is what I want to do. Are you okay with this? And the BBC, you can imagine the layers of bureaucracy that they have to go through.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why LBC is now attracting people like Eddie Mayer, Andrew Marr, John Sopel, Emily Maitlis, because they are fed up with all the constraints to their broadcasting. So, I mean, LBC is a great place to be.
Yeah, well, you absolutely anticipated my next question. And because I was going to ask, on the day that we're recording this, Andrew Marr is beginning his programme on LBC. It was announced last week. John Sopel and Emily Maitlis will be joining the station. So you do think that one of the main attractions of LBC over a place like the BBC right now is that people... Do you think people are fed up of the impartiality model, or do you think it's more than that? It's more kind of systemic and bureaucratic than that?
I think it's both in a way. I think more the latter than the former,
right,
in some ways. I mean, take Eddie Mayer as an example.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had, well, I mean, I haven't actually talked to him ever about his motivation for joining LBC, but I imagine it was that he wanted to be able to do things that maybe he wasn't allowed to do at the BBC. But on the other hand, he hasn't really become particularly opinionated.
No, he hasn't.
And I mean, Sheila Fogarty, when she came over, I think it took her probably 2 years. And she said this on a podcast I did with her recently, 2 years to really adapt to LBC and to discover that, oh, yes, she did have opinions.
Yeah.
And boy, she expressed them. And Andrew Marr, I think, is going to be fascinating because I think he said it in various interviews before he started, that he wants to get his voice back. And I mean, I know, if I say, for example, if I got an offer to go to the BBC today, whether it's 5 Live or Radio 4, I think I would turn, well, I suppose it depends what it is. If you want to be lead presenter of the Today programme, I suppose you'd be stupid to turn it down. Yeah. But they're never going to offer me that. But I couldn't do what I do on the BBC.
No.
I couldn't just be scripted all the time. That's just not me. Everyone thinks I must have a script that I operate from. I have in front of me at 7 o'clock a blank piece of paper. And I don't have any script whatsoever. When I go into an interview, I might have 4 or 5 bullet points of areas that I want to cover with somebody, if it's a really important politician, but I'll never have scripted questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have scripted questions, you then ask those scripted questions, and it's not a conversation. And I think I get the better interviews when I have a conversation with somebody rather than just going for the jugular right at the beginning. So I think it is the sort of freedom that LBC gives you. We don't have anybody saying to us, we want you to take this kind of angle. I mean, Twitter always assumes that there is an LBC corporate line. There is absolutely not. We have presenters from across the political spectrum, and we're encouraged to give our opinions. We're never told what our opinions should be. And if we ever were, I think that would be the day that I would quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's hugely interesting seeing the contrast between presenters on LBC. I'm wondering because obviously a lot of students will be listening to this. This is student radio. And I myself am a student journalist wanting to get into the industry. Do you think that the model of impartiality, balance, not being able to give your opinion on a lot of from a lot of publications or on a lot of stations, do you think that's should be a concern for people like me and for students wanting to get into the industry? Because I often find myself on my radio show sitting there thinking, should I be having a rant about this or expressing that opinion? Because that could come back to haunt me in a job interview in 5 years' time when an employer points to that and says, well, if people know you think that, then you can't work for us. It's quite a hard act to balance, isn't it?
I think it depends who you're broadcasting for.
Yeah.
I mean, impartiality for the state broadcaster, I think, is actually quite an important thing.
Mm.
But what does impartiality mean? Does it mean if you say one thing, you have to say, but of course, some other people say this? Well, that's what you do on the BBC.
Yeah.
I think I think that's the borders of that are being stretched at the moment, where you look at, for example, Stephen Nolan on Five Live, who is one of the best broadcasters in the business, I think. I've learned so much from him. I mean, he has opinions and he expresses them, but he knows where the borders are. Nikki Campbell is a little bit the same as well. And I just think if you're a radio phone-in host and all you're doing is say, well, let's go to Beth in Woodford Green. Okay, thanks, Beth. Let's go to Jim in Lewisham. Okay, I mean, how boring is that? You've got to surely insert yourself somehow into that conversation and encourage people to phone in and maybe provoke people a little bit. And there will be some times when I just play devil's advocate where I will say something that I actually don't believe. I mean, for example, if I interview somebody, often I get it in the neck for saying, I can't believe Ian Dale thinks that. And they only think I think that because I've asked a question of the interviewee just to play devil's advocate. I might be privately, I might be agreeing with the interviewee. But you are everyone wants to pigeonhole you, and there are no shades of grey here. It's black or white. You believe one thing or another. There can't possibly be a middle way. And in a way, I don't like that in the way that our national conversation has developed. But I don't think there's any way of going back on that.
How important do you think it is to be, well, I'm guessing you think it's important to be self-aware as a broadcaster and a journalist. But if you take the art of the interview, for example, you are a fantastic interviewer, in my opinion, but you have a very different style from someone like Andrew Neil or Emily Maitlis, who are perhaps more confrontational, more, you know, they clearly prep for interviews with sheets and sheets of statistics and almost to lay traps for politicians. And there is definitely, you know, a market for that, especially at election time. But I get the sense that the way you like to, you know, demonstrate what people think is to try and get into their heads, understand them as people more.
Well, that's actually a very perceptive question because, of course, I used to be on the other side of this. I used to be in politics. So I think in some ways, because I know how they think, because if I'm watching Question Time on the BBC, I will always think, oh God, how would I answer that question? And of course, sometimes you think, oh God, I wouldn't know what to say. But of course, when you're on it, I've done it a couple of times, the adrenaline flows and you do come up with some sort of answer. But maybe I can get inside their heads a little bit. But I don't go into an interview thinking I'm going to do you over, which I think some interviewers do.
You never think that? Anyone that you've ever thought, right, they need exposing or that kind of, has anyone tempted you like that?
I mean, in 12 years, I guess there must have been, but I can't readily think of anybody. I mean, even people like John McDonnell, who in essence I have little in common with in belief terms. I get news lines out of John McDonnell because I don't adopt a confrontational air with him. We have a conversation. And I quite like him. And sometimes you think, well, just because you like someone, then you see, people think, because I don't generally shout at an interviewee or I'm not gratuitously rude to them, therefore I must be a soft interviewer. Now, David Frost, who I think was one of the greatest interviewers of all time, everyone thought that he was a soft interviewer because he would lull people into a false sense of security, but he would always get the news lines. And I find that if I'm doing a half-hour interview, by minute 22, the producer's getting a bit nervous because they think, oh, this is a bit of a cozy chat. Where's the news line here? And invariably, the news line comes in minute 27 when they're perfectly comfortable. They've trotted out all of the sound bites that they had pre-prepared. And after sort of the first 10 minutes, they have to say something original because generally they don't do interviews for more than 10 minutes, so they're not used to it. And I mean, Theresa May, I remember doing an interview with her once, getting absolutely nowhere. She is an incredibly difficult person to interview. And sure enough, minute 27, I get the news line. And sometimes it is generally not prepared. Obviously, you know the subject that you're talking about, but you have to be aware that the person you're interviewing probably knows more about it than you do. And I remember interviewing Theresa May. This was just after her disastrous conference speech in 2017. Yeah. And it was, I thought she would cancel because I'd been trying to get her to do a phone-in with me for 18 months. So they'd set it up for the week after the party conference. Anyway, she turns up and she's not a natural phone-in person, but she was doing quite well. She answered a couple of questions really well. And then we had a lady from Italy wanting to ask about her rights after Brexit. Mm-hmm. And she gave an answer which was entirely unempathetic to this woman. So I then intervened. And I ended up asking her, if there was a second referendum, Prime Minister, how would you vote in that referendum? And she went to pieces. She had no answer. And she just said, well, it's a hypothetical question. I said, well, it isn't really, is it? Because there's a big movement for one. You voted Remain, and yet you're leading a Brexit government. I think the public would quite like to know how their Prime Minister would vote in this. But I did it in a very calm, non-confrontational way. And again, she gave a non-answer. And I said, well, I don't really understand why you can't answer this, because Jeremy Hunt answered it last week when I asked him the same question. He said he had voted Remain and he would now vote Leave. Why can't you do the same, Prime Minister? Now, her advisors were furious. And I knew that I would never interview her again after that. But I knew that I'd done the right thing. And that interview, I mean, it went everywhere. And Andrew Neil on This Week, he said every Conservative politician is now going to be asked the Ian Dale question. And I thought, my mission is complete. My life's work is done. I've got a compliment from Andrew Neil, who I think is a fantastic interviewer. But the thing is, you know, everybody has a different style. And if you try and become something that you're not, and if I try to become a shouty, rude interviewer, it doesn't work.
No.
And I mean, I have done interviews where I have, if I think someone's lying to me or deliberately trying to pull the wool over my eyes, I'll mix it with the best of them. But I don't automatically go into an interview thinking that's how it should be done.
No, of course. Are there any, so obviously that was a hugely newsworthy interview, that one. Are there any interviews either for one of your podcasts or live ones on the radio that really stand out as either one of your best interviews or one that had, you know, a huge impact politically? Are there any particular favourites, people you found most interesting who perhaps didn't expect to, maybe?
There's one that sticks out in my mind, which I did for my All Talk podcast, which is a podcast where I basically have conversations with people for an hour. This one went on for 2.5 hours. And it was with somebody who I know through my support of West Ham, who's nobody else has ever heard of. And I knew that he'd had quite an interesting life. So I said to him, do you want to come on my podcast? And he said, well, I looked through all the other guests and they're all really famous. And I said, well, the thing is, I want to chat to interesting people. And he was so interesting, a real sort of East End Cockney guy.
Yeah.
And it got quite emotional. He sort of had a little cry at one stage. I get very emotional very easily. And it was just a gripping listen. And that remains one of the most downloaded podcasts I've done. You don't have to get a star name guest to do a good interview. That is one that sticks in the mind. And again, on those podcasts, I know, often people say to me, well, don't you have any notes? Have you done no preparation? I say, no. I mean, I might have read their Wikipedia entry, and that is about the only preparation that I do, because I don't know where the conversation is going to go, but I want it to be a conversation. I don't really regard them necessarily as interviews. Memorable ones? Well, I did interview Donald Trump once.
Did you?
I'd actually forgotten that I'd done it, believe it or not. In about 2017, when he'd just been elected president, someone said, Why haven't you played that interview you did with Donald Trump back in 2012? And I suddenly thought, oh my God, I did interview Donald Trump. And he was coming over to host a business conference at the Excel Centre in London.
Yeah.
And he was in Trump Tower, I was in London, and it was just to sort of promote the conference, really. And I then listened back to it. It was about 12 minutes. And it was, again, it was like he was a normal person.
Mm.
It was a really interesting conversation. It was quite funny. He was a normal interviewee, and yet 5 years later, I mean, I'd have loved to have done an interview with him, but it certainly wouldn't. I don't think he would have come across in the way that he did in 2012. So that was me. I did Mike Pompeo, the Trump Secretary of State. That was quite awkward because that couldn't be a conversation. I had literally 8 minutes and I knew that I wouldn't be allowed to go over that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't look forward to it. I didn't enjoy it. Oh, it was okay.
Yeah.
But that's not the kind of, I don't like going into a hotel room to interview somebody. I want them on my turf, yeah. I suppose. Boris Johnson is an interesting one. I've interviewed him many times over the years. He is the most awkward person to interview because he never looks you in the eye. And if your interviewee doesn't look you in the eye, it's actually quite difficult to interrupt them. I mean, he's just looking everywhere apart from where you are. And he will go into some long monologue and you know you've got to stop him at some point because he'll just go on and on and on. Mm. And every interview I've ever done with him, at some point I've had to intervene and say, Boris, the idea of an interview is that I ask you a question, you answer it, and then I ask a follow-up.
And then he sometimes gets defensive, of course. When you say that sometimes, yeah.
It is, when you interview Boris, it is more of a joust. You know that it's going to be quite an awkward experience in some ways.
Quite exhausting, maybe.
And yeah, it absolutely is. And I did all the hustings between him and Jeremy, or I did 10 of them between him and Jeremy Hunt. And I did say to him before the first one, I said, look, we've only got a certain amount of time. Your whole shtick here is to convince Tory members. You're not going to do that if the whole time you're going off the subject. But of course, the first one, and this is probably, apart from the Theresa May interview, this is the interview where I probably got most media coverage for. It was the night after The Guardian reported that he had had a row with Carrie in the flat and spilt red wine, et cetera, et cetera. And the neighbour just happened to record it all, I mean, as you do. And so I said to Brandon Lewis, who was then party chairman, I said, you know, I'm going to have to ask him about this on stage. And he said, well, you do what you have to do. Boris came up to me in the green room and said, you're not going to ask about all of this newspaper stuff, are you? I said, well, I've got to kind of mention it. It is leading all the news bulletins. I look a bit of a dick if I don't. So I assumed that he would then mention it himself in his little speech before the Q&A. He didn't. So he sat down, first question, can you tell us what happened last night that's provoked all of these headlines? Well, Ian, I don't think people want to hear about that sort of thing. I think they want to hear what I'm going to do for them, sort of cut their taxes, et cetera, et cetera. I said, no. I think they do. The police were involved. It's a public issue. So therefore, I think people here do want to. And then he started talking about red buses, which I thought was quite a talent. So I then went back again, and the audience then started to boo. But at the time, I thought they were booing me, which I thought was hilarious. I wanted to burst out laughing because I thought it was hilarious. But it wasn't. It was because, well, I think some of them were booing me, but some of them were booing him for not answering the question. Anyway, I had 5 goes and I thought, you know what? I'm getting nowhere with this. People can make up their minds now. I don't need to go on any further. I mean, I could have done a Paxman and gone 12 times, but what's the point? Mm. And I hadn't realised that this was all being broadcast live on Sky and the BBC. And I didn't switch my mobile phone on until about an hour after the event had finished. And it went into meltdown, basically. And apparently Sky were just repeating it ad nauseum. Wow. And I wasn't sure if I had done the right thing there in any of it, in the way that I approached it. But I had texts from people like Nick Robinson, Andrew Neil, saying, bloody good job. You did a really good... And when you get that kind of feedback from people who know what they're doing, you think, okay, it's fine.
It went well, yeah.
But I knew that I would never interview Boris Johnson again.
And you haven't?
No.
Wow.
And I never will.
Gosh, that's fascinating. Thank you so much. We're almost out of time. Just one last question. Again, a question on my behalf as well as my listeners. For people trying to break into this industry, an extremely competitive industry, do you have any, whether it be specific or broad, advice for the best way to try and get your foot in the ladder in broadcasting and journalism?
It is more difficult now. Yeah. I remember I had, back in 1994, I think it was, I had an intern when I was running a lobbying company and he wanted to get into the media. So I said to him, well, go down to 4 Mill Bank and go and make Adam Bolton's tea for a few weeks, which he then went down and offered to help. And that's what he did. To cut a long story short, he ended up becoming editor of Tonight with Trevor MacDonald and This Morning.
Wow.
So I take all the credit for that.
Yeah.
Joe Pike, who you'll know, who's a political correspondent on Sky News, he came to intern for me when I ran a magazine called Total Politics. And he's got on in the world because he's been in the right place at the right time. I recommended him to go to LBC as a report. He did brilliantly at that. Ended up at ITV in Edinburgh, I think, and then some of the other regions, and is now on Sky News. You kind of have to be in the right place at the right time. You have to keep kicking doors down, which is easier said than done nowadays, because I think most broadcasters now require a broadcast journalism degree. So after you've done your normal degree, you need to go and do that somewhere at City University, Cardiff, wherever. If you want to get into certainly LBC, that is normally a requirement. There are exceptions. I mean, we had an 18-year-old. How he got into the building, I don't know. It wasn't. We don't have. Daddy doesn't get you a job at our place, but I can't remember how he actually got in. And he turned out to be one of the most brilliant producers we've ever had. And within 6 months, he was on the Nick Ferrari team, which, as you know, the breakfast program on any radio station is the most important one. And he's now unfortunately taken a career downward step to go to GB News, but I suppose they greased his palm a little bit to do that. But I mean, that he's an exception to the rule, and the rule is get your qualifications and then go and make a pest of yourself.
Yeah.
And offer to start at the bottom, get some shifts answering the phones. And I mean, certainly at LBC, if you answer the phones well and you sort of really make an impression, you will then become a producer at some point and be taken on full time. But you do have to prove yourself. I can't make any recommendations on sort of on the written press side.
No.
But in my experience, if you're any good, you will get somewhere. But you do have to make a bit of a nuisance of yourself. I mean, I've had various people who've emailed me over the years and said, look, I listen to your show a lot. Can I come and shadow it? And I mean, I'm saying this, of course, now it's going to provoke a lot more. and I can think of four or five of them who've ended up working full-time jobs because they've come in, they've shown a real interest in what we're doing. They then get some AP shifts.
Yep.
And it's kind of then up to you as to what you make of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's very encouraging and very, very lovely of you to join us. Thank you so much, Ian Dell. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Absolutely fascinating.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.